Okay, welcome back to the Investigative Journal on this October 6th, 2014 day in our calendar. I'm your host, Greg Anthony. You are listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com, and you can hear my show every night from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m., that's Pacific Time, Monday through Friday. Now, today I want to concentrate on some of the legal proceedings in the Tony Alamo Ministry case. Now, one thing that I've been doing over the months is reporting on this case, one reason that many people haven't heard about it. If they did hear about it, it was years ago when the government did a SWAT raid on this Christian ministry and alerted 150 news media outlets about the impending arrest of Tony Alamo on violations of the Mann Act, which means that he transported, the government was saying, minors across state lines for sexual purposes. And this was trumpeted all across the country, that he was, basically guilty before even given a trial. And if you look at the articles and what went on, right after that, of course, Oprah Winfrey got involved. Oh, I've seen things from Matt Damon saying, good that this man is in jail. So it was an orchestrated effort to basically convict him in the public's eye. And then when you look at the legal proceedings, now I've talked a lot about the public proceedings, and I've talked a lot about some of the evidence, some of the testimony, some of the things regarding the victims. There were four or five girls that testified against Tony Alamo, and I've tried to piece through their testimony, showing that it was flimsy, showing that they were coerced by the government. And when I say those things, I don't say them lightly. And in the future, I will go over that again. But I said a long time ago, I wanted to concentrate on the legal proceedings in this case. And it's extensive. And it's going to take me a while. So I'm going to do this over a period of time so that people can get an idea of what really went on here. I said earlier that I believe that this man was framed and this ministry was torn apart because there was a twofold thing going on here. They charged him with these crimes, and then they rounded up, the government tried to round up every kid that was ever involved in this ministry, and the parents, a lot of the parents had headed for the hills just to protect their kids. They started in Fauk, Arkansas, when they raided this ministry and took six or seven kids who were playing on the grounds away from their parents. And then the judge put out an order that, because the ministry had several churches all over the country, that anybody involved in the Alamo ministry should be picked up and taken into custody. And so eventually they rounded up 35 to 40 kids, and or even more. And what went on with the custody hearings is also a good part of this case. This case is not only Tony Alamo. It's probably threefold here. We got the legal proceedings in the criminal case against Tony, which I'm going to go over. Then we got the legal proceedings in the custody cases, which is unbelievable here. And you're going to see some evidence that's going to shake. I mean, you're going to hear government employees lying. You're going to hear things that, man, just rocked the foundation of what our country was built on, the Constitution allowing freedom of speech first. Because I said, I believe this all began because Tony was very, in his ministry, was outspoken against the Vatican's control of our foreign and domestic policy, their rewritings of the Bible, their basic infiltration of churches throughout the country. And he'd been doing this for 40 years, and I believe this is why this happened. And however, when you see, first of all, the irregularities in his legal proceeding, in his criminal case, then you see the illegal irregularities in the custody cases, which was a big part of this. Then you see the illegal irregularities in the civil cases, which then came third, the third prong in this, the threefold attempt to dismantle this ministry, and that was to get their assets, to get their money, to get their property, which is extensive. And in Arkansas alone, they were, in the civil case, there was a judgment of $532 million against this ministry, which was the largest in Arkansas history. And this goes deeper than that. It goes into California. It goes into their other holdings. And this was a concerted effort to destroy a Christian ministry that, one, talked against the Vatican, that was quite successful, and, three, it was an effort to just basically hit Tony below the belt, then to take the kids, and then to get their assets and dismantle this Christian ministry, which served as an example for any other Christian ministry that doesn't get in lockstep with the Vatican, that this could happen to you. Now, before I get into some of the legal, some of the technicalities, we're going to start off with Tony's motion to quash this whole case, his appeal, which is still sitting on a judge's desk. It was filed, I believe, in 2012 in November, and there hasn't been any action on it. As of today, if something happens in the next days, I will let you know. But let's carefully look at some of the constitutional protections that we are supposed to have in this country that we don't if we speak up against the Vatican. Now, the most sacred principle of the United States Constitution is the equality of every citizen before the law. But the fundamental principle of the Church of Rome is the denial of that equality. And what I say by that is, if you look at the charges against Tony, and then you look at some of the way they've handled these abuse cases, which I'm telling you, you will see a double standard here. And the fundamental principle of Rome is that we are the ones that dole out who goes to jail and who doesn't. And if you look at the abuse cases of the Church of Rome, all around the world and in our country, and those that have been covered up, and the way the government has handled those compared to us, to the way they handled this case, and the way they would handle you if you talked against them, is night and day. He received no protection on our laws. The government in our country protects these people, even if they violated the law. And I've seen a long string of this ever since Cardinal Spellman, and I've had police officers and other people testify on this show, that Spellman, who was, if you remember, one of the most powerful men in our country, Cardinal Spellman of New York, who was the chaplain of our military during the Vietnam War, and he was protected when he was caught red-handed abusing children. Now, the liberty of conscience is proclaimed by the United States, correct? A most sacred principle which every citizen must uphold, even at the price of his blood. But liberty of conscience is declared by all the popes and councils of Rome a most godless, unholy, and diabolical thing which every good Catholic must abhor and destroy at any cost. And when I say good Catholic, I mean those that are, you know, might not be the woman that goes to church every Sunday, but it could be, and it is, the leaders of our country who work for this group. The American Constitution also assures the absolute independence of the civil from the ecclesiastical or church power. But the Church of Rome declares that such independence is an impiety and revolt against God. Their 200 concordats and legal agreements with countries around the world prove this, including ours. I won't go any farther because we've discussed that on other shows. Fourth, the American Constitution leaves every man free to serve God according to the dictates of his conscience. But the Church of Rome declares that no man has ever had such a right, and that the Pope alone can know and say what man must believe and do, and that's why they came down on this ministry. And they would come down on yours or your beliefs if you become popular, if you become a pain in their neck, so to speak, if you reach a lot of people. They will do the same thing to you that they did to this ministry. Now, the Constitution of the United States denies the right for anybody to punish any other for differing from him in religion. But the Church of Rome says that she has the right to punish with the confiscation of their goods or the penalty of death those who differ in faith from the Pope. This ministry differed in faith from the Pope, expressed it openly for 40 years, in a manner that was enlightening a lot of people, and it wasn't so much only on their religious views, but on the secular activities of this institution. And for that, what does it say? The Church of Rome says that she has the right to punish with the confiscation of their goods, and that's exactly what they're doing here. Now, the United States has established schools all over their immense territories, haven't they, where they invite the peoples to send their children, that they may cultivate their intelligence and become good and useful citizens. That's what we're told. But the Church of Rome has publicly cursed all these schools and forbidden their children to attend them under pain of excommunication in this world and damnation in the next. Now, that's what they've said behind our backs. In America, they play a double-edged sword. They allow the public institutions to grow but control them, and that's why there's a dumbing down of America. Now, the Constitution of the United States is based on the principle that people are the primary source of all civil power. But hundreds of times, the Church of Rome has proclaimed that this principle is impious and heretical. She says that all governments must rest upon the foundation of the Catholic Church, with the Pope alone as the legitimate and infallible source and interpreter of the law. Now, that's what they really say behind the scenes. We don't hear that in public, of course, but that's why this country is going to hell in a handbasket, in short. Now, let me get to some of these legal proceedings. And this is not going to be an easy task for me or your listeners, because any time you get into legal proceedings, you're going to have to pay attention. And frankly, radio shows have become more entertainment than substance. But hopefully on this show, we still believe in a little bit of substance. Now, I went to law school, so I understand these proceedings quite well. I understand the words. I'll try to explain some of them. But I want to go through this meticulously with you. Because if you ever get in trouble with these people, this is what you're going to go through. You're going to go through the legal mumbo-jumbo. But let me just synthesize this whole thing real quickly. When you look, we're going to just concentrate. I'm going to put the custody cases and the civil case aside for another show, not other shows. But let's just look at the criminal case against the head of this ministry, Tony Alamo, which began somewhere in 2008, 2009, when they stormtroopered his ministry in a big public display. Now, when they arrest these priests that have, I believe, committed so many more dastardly crimes than this, and when I show you this, I don't even believe that there were any crimes committed in this case. But you can use the legal system to frame people if you want to. I've seen it happen many times. Look at the Tupper Saucy case I worked on. I've been telling you about. They charged him with the law that didn't even exist, and they put him in jail, but he didn't go in. He went on the lam and wrote a book about it. But anyway, how many people would do that? Not many. Many people would just walk lockstep right into jail on something they didn't do. Now, in this case, Tupper was only facing a year and a half of his life. This man was facing 175 years, and he's in jail right now. And when you look at this case, you're going to say, my goodness, first, did he get a fair trial? I don't believe he did. Secondly, many of the witnesses, we're going to get into this, a very important part. I'll get into this after I'm going to try to go back and forth with this, but I'm going to start by reading some of his motion to get a new trial, an evidentiary hearing requested to vacate, set aside these charges and these convictions, and also look at all the witnesses. It's so interesting, and there are depositions and witnesses that wanted to testify, including John Peeler, this undercover agent for the FBI, who's he's been on my show numerous times. I've got his, you know, you can see he sent to the court, you know, a sworn testimony that he was working undercover for the FBI. And they never got to testify. There were at least 10 to 15, 20 witnesses that could have helped Tony in this case that never got to say anything. Now, how can you get a fair trial when this goes on? Now, I don't think he had a good, in the beginning, he's got another attorney now, but his original attorney, I don't know whether they were on the take or what, or they were working together with the government. Who knows what goes on behind the scenes? But there are many cases. Why weren't these people allowed to testify on his behalf? Now, for example, the FBI, you know, look at the custody cases here. You're going to find that there were some DHS, some people that were working for the government and the Child Protective Services that lied under oath. And they probably, you know, when you read what happened, and then they were trying to, they did a deposition on one man, and then they found out evidence that he had lied point blank. He said he knew nothing about the Tony Alamo case when he knew much about the case. And then I hear some feeble excuse in one of the legal documents I read that Peeler wasn't involved in the FBI. Well, you know, the FBI, it's kind of like you weren't in the CIA, you know. Do you ever remember when I did a story about, Dangerous Dan Marvin? A good friend of mine, a Vietnam hero, I think, that told the truth about Vietnam. And he was the original Green Beret undercover. And he was given the a number of hits to do. And basically, you go off the rolls. If something happens to you and you get caught, there's no record of you. You can never prove that you were there or that you were in the United States military. And the same thing with the FBI. If you're working undercover and they want to wipe you clean of any involvement with them, they can do it. And what's the evidence going to say? Oh, we don't have any record that John Peeler ever worked with us. I don't believe it. And if you want to, we'll go over his sworn, he sent in a request to be heard and gave it to the court, and we'll go over what he said. But let's start with this motion that Tony has filed. I got about 6 minutes here before the break, and then I'll get into this. But let's start with his motion to get a new trial. And this evidentiary hearing request showing a lot of the irregularities. Now, this is a 50-page document. I'm going to go over it as best I can. It's going to take some time. I don't want to miss some things because these are the things you're going to have to go through, folks, if something ever happens to you. Now, most people just shut up, never do anything. In fact, a lot of people listen to this and go, oh, it can't be true because why isn't the media talking about it? Why is just Greg and a couple other people talking about it? Well, that's interesting because, you know, I've gotten a lot of emails from people over the months now. One just the other day stating, God, I cannot believe this is going on. I've got to contact the ministry. I can't believe this happened. This can't be true. Oh, it be true. And it happens right here in America. And all those protections that our Constitution is supposed to give us that I read at the beginning of this show that are subjugated or subverted by the Vatican and our government is why I say that on paper, yes, we have the freest country in the world, but in reality we don't because it is not adhered to. And once you get involved in all these legal proceedings, man, you are in for the ride of your life. And let me tell you, one thing I did learn in law school was that never be in the wrong place at the wrong time or offend the wrong people that control this country because you will not have a chance in hell to ever get a fair trial. Now, comes the movement here. This is what they say movement, Bernie Lazar Hoffman. Or Mr. Hoffman, by and through his counsel, respectfully moves the Honorable Court to vacate, set aside, or correct his conviction and sentence pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 2255. Now, we're going to continue on and look at some of the procedural history in this case. so that you understand exactly where we're sitting here now. Mr. Hoffman, who is serving an aggregate now, that his he goes by the name of Tony Alamo, but his legal name is Mr. Hoffman. It's also interesting that Tony was born Jewish, who is serving an aggregate sentence of 2,100 months imprisonment. Is incarcerated at this time in 2012 in the prison in Marion, Illinois. The prison's address is 4500 Prison Road, Marion, Illinois, 62959, if you want to send him a letter. Movement's Bureau of Prisons register number is 00305-112. Now, on June 11, 2009, a 10-count second superseding indictment was returned against Mr. Hoffman, charging him with 9 counts of transportation of a minor with intent to engage in a criminal sexual activity, aided and abetted by others, 18 U.S.C. 2423, and 1 count of transportation of a minor with intent to engage in criminal sexual activity, aided and abetted by others, attempt or conspiracy, 18 U.S.C. 2423. AE counts 2, count 10, so it was 1 through 10. Movement pled not guilty to all these counts. And here's the question. What did I just say? All right. There's a law in the books called the Mann Act, and if you transport a minor from one state to another with the intent to have sex, you can be arrested and charged with these crimes. Now, you have to remember in this case that there were many. Tony has a number of ministries from Arkansas to L.A. to other places, and he travels a lot on tours and different things. I don't believe there was ever any intent proved in this case. And in the beginning, I believe that's what the people close to Tony in the ministry felt. We were taking trips all the time. Many of our people were traveling on buses, doing different things, traveling. And there was never any intent to commit any sexual acts, but they used this Mann Act against him. Now, in June 23, 2009, let me check the time. I don't want to go over here. I've got about, a minute and a half. I'll just do this real quick, and then we'll come back and continue. On June 23, 2009, Movement filed his motion to suppress, which was denied on July 10, 2009. Movement proceeded to trial, and after a 10-day jury trial, 10 days, my God, that's a short trial. No wonder. 10 days he was convicted on 10 counts in the second superseding indictment on July 24, 2009. We got about a minute, so let me stop there. Now, when you get... I've seen trials for, you know, petty larceny go on longer than 10 days, but you've got a guy he's facing 175 years, and you got all these people, you got 4 or 5 defendants. When you look at all the people that never were allowed to testify in his behalf, and I'll read that legal document to you later, a 10-day trial, and he's in jail for 175 days. A 10-day jury trial was convicted on all 10 counts in the second superseding indictment on July 24. He was represented at trial. We'll get into those guys. Who cares what their names are, but I don't think he got a fair shake in the beginning. But anyway, we're going to continue with some of these legal proceedings in the Alamo case after these short messages.
Hear it first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net. The The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on internet or our several affiliates. If you benefit by the educational law programs, we ask you to give. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. These programs are not commercially viable and must be supported by those faithful to the cause of truth. Look for the button to sponsor your favorite programs at our listen and schedule pages on the internet. Then, when you subscribe, we will send you the last quarterly MP3 CD of that program immediately and continue to do so with each new quarter. We will also give you unlimited archive access to all of our programs. We're asking you to give much less than a tithe so that you may also send support directly to a particular program host, cause, and anywhere else the Spirit may lead you. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening. Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Okay, we're back for the second half hour of the Investigative Journal. I'm your host, Greg Anthony. And I believe, what's happening in the Tony Alamo case, or happened in the case, and what's going on even to this day while they're trying to get every one of their assets and dismantle this ministry, basically eradicate it, is a sign of the times. Something came out in the Washington Times, if you remember way back, regarding 9/11, that shows you that we are in the hands of the Pope. Now, when I say that, most people roll their eyes and go, that's impossible. Well, it's not impossible, because in our country, leadership begins from the top down, and it works its way all the way into our federal courts and into our states, etc. And if you remember, right around 9/11, we saw that the President of the United States declared openly in the Washington Times that he is going to obey the Pope. If so, if he does, he must destroy the Constitution. And that is basically logical thinking. Remember what I said in the early parts of the first part of this show? You can't have one and the other together. But Bush apparently had followed the Pope's agenda to the letter. And let me read this to you from the 50 Years in the Church of Rome by Charles Chiniqui. Nothing is plainer than that. If the principles of the Church of Rome prevail here, our Constitution will fail. The two cannot exist together. They are in open and direct antagonism with the fundamental theory of our government and all popular government everywhere. Now, in the destruction of that World Trade Center, and now remember the Murrah building in Oklahoma City, these were planned events, folks, for the specific purpose of creating terror in this country. And this fear would give way to constitutional liberties and freedoms that we've always had. And this plan by the Jesuits is working extremely well. With politicians, schools and colleges, the media, big corporations, and the government, the courts in their hands, America is rapidly being defeated from within. This case that I'm reading to you today is an example of what will happen to you if you speak up again, if you talk like this and you have a large audience like the Alamo Ministry had. And to prove that our country is in the hands of the Pope, remember what he said, Bush said. We are on a crusade here, a crusade to when we went into Iraq after the Trade Center. Now, American troops prepared to do battle with an extreme Muslim faction in Afghanistan. What are we doing today? The same thing with ISIS. Here we go again. And the president says, quote, in USA Today, the president is saying, he said this, his administration is readying a crusade against terrorism. That was said in the USA Today. Bush said it in other places, remember? Oh, yes. And he was on a ship, if I remember, an aircraft carrier. Now, folks, just to remind you, crusades were Catholic holy wars fought during the Dark Ages against Muslim hordes who refused to relinquish Jerusalem to the Pope. You know, presidents carefully construct their speeches, and their speechwriters carefully construct them. If they want us to believe that there is a separation of church and state, they shouldn't have never. They would have never used the word crusade. But if they have some kind of secret communication, knowing that the dumbing down of Americas will never figure this out, that's exactly what was going on. What does George Bush mean by a crusade, folks? What did he mean? Alberto Rivera, who was an ex-Jesuit priest in his Crusader series, has made it clear that the Vatican created Islam to destroy Christians and Jews, protect Roman Catholics, and to capture Jerusalem for the Pope. So we have their plan said to you in a simple sentence. Now, let's get back to what I was doing regarding the Alamo case. And we're at a point here where on November 13th, 2009, in his recent 2012 motion to appeal, a secondary appeal, let's call it that, or a motion to quash and get a new trial, etc., etc. In 2009, he was sentenced to 2,100 months in prison based on consecutive sentences of varying lengths imposed on each of the 10 counts of conviction. And there was a fine of $250,000 was imposed. And on January 13, 2010, a restitution hearing was held and Movement was sentenced to $2.5 million in restitution to the five victims. That since has been really upped. The ante has gone higher in the civil case, and I'll get into that at another time. But Mr. Hoffman timely appealed his conviction and sentenced to the Eighth Circuit right after his conviction. And in direct appeal, his counsel raised two grounds for relief: sufficiency of evidence and abuse of discretion in statements made by the court at sentencing. Okay. So, the evidence, basically what his original appeal was based on was the evidence was insufficient to support the verdicts in each of the 10 counts because the government failed to show that a dominant purpose or intent of the interstate travel was for sex with a minor. Now, two, the district court abused its discretion and violated due process by giving the appearance of factoring in an improper or irrelevant factor its own sense of religiosity in imposing this 2,100-month sentence. Pretty heavy-duty sentence. When you look at the evidence in this case, it's incredible to me. On December 2, 2010, the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed Mr. Hoffman's conviction. See United States v. Hoffman, 626 F. 3rd, 993, 8th Circuit, 2010. That's how you find all these cases, folks. Now, I remember when I first went to law school back in when I was 20, I think I was 22 years old, and when I spent a year before I left and became a journalist and did okay the first year. I passed. There was no internet. You had to go into the, you had to take a course in library legal doc, you know, how to find things. Because if you can't find anything, you're never going to understand the legal, and it's difficult. So we had to take a course in how to find things in the legal library. Now, fast forward, when I finally got my degree, years later, computers made it much easier, basically. But anyway, you can find that case. It's 626 F. 3rd, 993, 8th Circuit, 2010. Mr. Hall filed a petition in the United States Supreme Court. That petition raised single ground for relief. So he went to the Supreme Court. Decision of the Court of Appeals is contrary to the Commerce Clause requirement in Mortensen v. United States, and that the dominant purpose of the trip in a Mann Act prosecution must be unlawful sex, which was never proven. And basically, the Court of Appeals unconstitutionally permits prosecution if sex ever happened without regard to proof of purpose. Now, his case was denied to be heard by the Supreme Court. Just so you know, the Supreme Court has discretion of hearing these cases. They don't have to hear every case that comes before them. So they're, and it's called certiorari, C-E-R, certiorari, okay, I forgot how it was pronounced, was denied on June 13th, 2011. Now, beyond the direct appeal and petition for certiorari detailed above, Movement had previously filed no other motions, petitions, or applications concerning this judgment of conviction in any court at any time. He filed this 225 motion in this case. Movement did not testify at any pretrial hearing, trial, or post-trial hearing in this matter. Because Mr. Hoffman's one-year limitation began to run from the date his conviction became final, the date his petition for certiorari was denied, he had 1 year from that date on June 13, 2012, to file the 28 U.S.C. 2255 motion. See United States versus Moore. His motion under 28 U.S.C. 2255 to vacate, set aside a correct sentence by a person or in federal custody and incorporated brief support were timely filed in this court June 11, 2012. So he's timely filed everything. And that's important. You miss it by a day, you ain't going to get anything. I'm telling you, that's why a lot of attorneys get disbarred. They miss their deadlines. But anyway, in this case, they filed it timely. And should we do a little factual background on this? So we remember, and I've talked about this case, but if we look at this in... here's the factual background. All this is public record. Mr. Hoffman was indicted on October 1, 2008. On October 17, 2008, John Wesley Hall entered his appearance as counsel for Mr. Hoffman. On March 17, 2009, just over 2 months before the scheduled trial date of May 18, 2009, and less than 4 months before the eventual trial date in this matter, Dan Davis entered his appearance as attorney for Mr. Hoffman in this matter. Mr. Davis, who is based in Beverly Hills, California, charged a $350,000 retainer for his services. Now, let me tell you something here. When you look at these charges, and you get paid $350,000, I would expect a little bit better work. During the same time he entered his appearance, Mr. Davis insisted that Mr. Hall be dismissed as counsel, and he was so dismissed. As the size of his retainer and insistence on the firing Mr. Hall would suggest, Davis was hired as lead counsel to handle the bulk of the trial preparation in this case. In discussions with Mr. Hoffman, Davis represented that he had an open schedule and would be blocking out the majority of his time to work on this case. Well, he better. Despite these representations, Mr. Davis was largely unavailable during the weeks before the May trial date. He tried other cases, went on vacation, and scheduled surgeries for a sports injury. Now, off the record, this is not in the case. Now, when you look at this, here's a guy that charges the guy $350,000. Says he's going to make most of, at this particular point, he shouldn't be going on vacation, shouldn't be trying other cases. He should have a team working, digging deeply into all these charges. We're not dealing here, we're dealing with a man act, with intent. And when you look at I've read to you in the past the testimony. Now, if this attorney was acting in this manner, I'm telling you, something was up in Denmark. On May 5th, 2009, attorney Jeffrey Harrelson then files a motion to continue in this case on behalf of Mr. Davis, requesting a 120-day continuance of the trial date. See motion to continue. In the motion and his affidavit in support of that motion, Mr. Davis noted that minimal or no investigation had been conducted to date prior by counsel. Mr. Holland, that because of delays in his receiving notice of the identity of the complaining witnesses, referring to in the indictment as Jane Doe's, as well as delays in his receiving discovery in this case, he had other attorneys entered on the case were unprepared to go to trial. So one guy's shoving it off on the other, so to speak. Hey, he didn't do it. It's not my fault. I didn't do it well. This guy didn't do it. He didn't do it well. Well, we got to delay this thing. When in fact they collected $350,000 and didn't do anything, probably. In his affidavit attached to the motion to continue, Mr. Davis asserted that he and Mr. Hoffman's other counsel would be ineffective unless granted 120 days. Okay, so they're saying, give him the benefit of the doubt. So now they're asking for more time. We got to gather the evidence, so to speak. So let's not, just give him a little bit of benefit of the doubt here. In his affidavit attached to the Mr. Davis asserted that he and Mr. Hoffman's other counsel would be ineffective unless granted that 120 days continuance. Mr. Irvin later confirmed that Davis had accomplished little, if anything, in investigating Mr. Hoffman's case or preparing it for trial, noting that, "I am unaware of any trial preparation, investigation, or general work that Mr. Davis contributed." Jeez, I'm not even a comment right now on this. And you wonder why I didn't want to practice law. Is it a license to steal, maybe? Legal license to, there are good attorneys out there who will work for their money, but apparently, in a legal document right here, it's all public record. You can read it yourself. He didn't do anything. And this guy's supposed to get a fair trial? And then he gets a 10-day trial and he's convicted. On May 8th, 2009, the court provided only a 57-day continuance to the trial date. So instead of giving the guy 120 days, they gave him 57. Now, why did they gave him 57? I don't know. Why not 58? 63 days short of the time Davis himself estimated was needed to prepare to an extent that would result in effective assistance of counsel. So one guy screws up, even he screws up and says, they're going to need 120 days to get this right. Now, I don't know whatever happened to the $350,000. I haven't seen anything here yet. Maybe they gave some of it back. I'll find out what happened to that. But during meetings at the time of the motion, hearing on the motion to continue, Davis conducted himself, this is in the public record, by the recent motion for a new trial, motion to quash everything, by the new attorney, I've told is doing a decent job. During meetings at the time of the motion hearing on the motion to continue, Davis conducted himself, according to this document, in an unprofessional, combative, and defeatist manner, which in combination with his failure to devote his full attention to the case in the preceding months, ultimately led to his termination as counsel on May 18, 2009. As evidenced in a termination agreement signed that day, as well as May 19, 2009 letter from Mr. Davis to the court. In that letter to the court, Mr. Davis noted that, I feel confident that in the immediate future, defense attorney Don Irvin will inform court and counsel who shall be designated new lead counsel, perhaps obviating the need for any formal motion to withdraw. On or about June 19, 2009, a formal motion to withdraw Mr. Davis's counsel was filed with court document 7278. Mr. Davis' departure necessitated an even longer continuance than the 120 days that he estimated in his May 5, 2009 motion to continue, as associated attorneys who had been retained as counsel now or the discrete elements of the case, such as the bond challenge, were forced into sharing the role of lead counsel in the case, and an additional attorney was hired to assist in preparing the case for trial of Mr. Kuhn. Nevertheless, in the wake of Davis's firing and drastic change in circumstances it occasioned, Mr. Hoffman's attorney, Mr. Davis, failed to seek trial continuance based on Mr. Davis's departure and the resulting lack of procedure preparedness to bring the case to trial. Now, okay, so we have, in the beginning of this case, got about 6 minutes here, and like I said, this is a tedious matter, but an important matter, isn't it? When you look at this, quite important, that in the beginning of this case, he basically didn't even get a fair shake. I mean, his attorney collects, his original attorney collects all this money, and so I'm showing that in the beginning here, it's got a stinky smell to it, doesn't it? And in good faith, he paid a good deal of money to get a legal counsel. The Mann Act, pretty, you know, it has to show intent, and you got four or five victims here claiming this violation of the Mann Act. Then, when you see in other documents that I'll present, that all these witnesses that wanted to testify, that were given over to the attorneys, that were never contacted, shows to me that there was something weird going on here. And the legal document basically stated that Mr. Davis didn't do a very good job, did he? Now, we got some evidence at trial, okay, that we got to go over. And we got about five or six minutes. I'll start with it. Mr. Hoffman was tried, like I said, and convicted on 9 counts of transportation of a minor with intent to engage in criminal sexual activity. And I went over those counts, right? Tony outlined below that the evidence, which was adduced at trial, that went to the elements of each of the counts of the conviction, as well as the evidence presented by the defense, would serve to rebut the essential elements of the crimes charged. The factual calls on each of the 10 counts were close ones because the convictions turned on gleaning Mr. Hoffman's dominant purposes for transporting individuals who were part of his household, sometimes traveling in response to their own requests or back to their parents' residence from circumstantial evidence. In addition, each count required a jury finding that movement was aided and abetted by others. Instruction 9 instructed the jury that a person who has no knowledge that a crime is being committed or about to be committed, but who happens to act in a way which advances some offense, does not thereby become an aider or abettor. There was a very little testimony indicating that the individuals who drove the young women were aware that a crime was being committed or was about to be committed, and any such finding must have rested on circumstantial evidence. Now, we get to count one and count two. And we're going to use Jane Doe names here. Remember I read to you in other shows some of the background information of these counts and what the allegations were. Well, I think in tomorrow's show or Wednesday, I'll try to get to it tomorrow. I'll get into the specific counts. And looking at this, it's to me a travesty of justice that this man is sitting in jail for 2,100 months and only got a 10-day trial. And it all started out pretty sad, didn't it, from what I read? So I'm going to go over those individual accounts. I only got about a minute left on this show. And there's much, much more. And if you ask yourself, you know, why am I so intent on reading all this stuff to you? This gives you an idea, folks, of how our system can be manipulated, I believe, to put somebody behind bars and a Christian ministry that's talking against who I consider to be the enemy within our country. And this is what happens to you. And I think it's important that we see everything in violation, our Constitution being subverted. We see a man not getting a fair trial. We see it all right before us, his property taken. The question you have to ask is, are you just going to keep quiet? Or are you going to say something? Or are you going to be frightened that if you do say something against this organization, you may end up like him? Those are a lot of pretty heavy questions. But anyway, we'll discuss them on other shows, and I'll be back tomorrow with the Investigative Journal. Thanks for listening, and have a good evening.